You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A new performance piece called If You See Something, Say Something combines journalism, personal stories, and astute observation to reveal unexpected connections between the birth of the atomic bomb, the Department of Homeland Security, and daily life in post-9/11 America. It's a monologue written and performed by Mike Daisy and directed by his wife, Jean-Michel Gregory, with no video projections, no music, no lighting effects, and it's at Joe's Pub at the Public Theater through November 30th. It brings Mike Daisy to the show now. Hi.
Hello.
And you open your monologue with a description of a visit to Trinity Site at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. Why did you want to visit that? Is it because it's only open one day a week?
One day a year.
I
think that played an issue. There was something about the idea of a place that's a national monument that no one in the nation can actually visit except for one day a year. That certainly resonated with me. But more than that, I think that and this is sort of explored in the piece itself, but I've been fascinated by the Manhattan Project and by the Cold War all my life. And so the idea – I've always wanted to visit the place where the first bomb had been detonated.
Were the other kids you were growing up with in Maine also fascinated by the possibility of total destruction?
Oh, I think many of them were. I think many kids of my generation growing up in the 80s we talked about it constantly. It was like kind of an omnipresent force, sort of hung in the air above everyone.
And it probably was less so than if you'd grown up in the 50s, where we used to climb under desks to protect ourselves against the atomic blast as though it was going to save us from all the radiation.
Yeah, I often wonder which was worse, because in the 50s you at least had the illusion that you could do something, whereas in the 80s it was very clear to all of us that there was no hope. Where we lived in northern Maine is near Loring Air Force Base, and it was clear that would be a first strike target. And so there was sort of this very odd sense that if things did happen you shouldn't even bother to try to do anything because you would simply die.
So what was it like that day at the Trinity site? Were there a lot of other people who also felt that they had to visit?
Well, it's a remarkable thing because kind of a very motley and fascinating collision of people go to visit. You know, it's not very well advertised. I'm pretty certain the Department of Defense is not very happy about even the fact that they have this. It was because of an agreement between the Department of Defense and the Department of the Interior that they even have this compromise where there's a day where people can go. So it's a very odd collection, a lot of families, a lot of weird loners. I guess I would be in that category. And a lot of older people. There were some men that had worked on the Manhattan Project and men that had been associated with it. And so it's sort of an odd convention of people out there in the desert.
Is it still hot?
Radioactive?
Yeah.
Yes. It's what they've done is they've shoveled all the Trinitite underground, because, you know, you don't get the EPA to clean up your nuclear crater if you, you're cleaning up a nuclear crater. So what they've done is they've used bulldozers and they shoveled all the radioactive glass underground. But so the surface is only 10 to 15 times normal radiation. But people show me throughout the day that if you put your Geiger counter into the sand, for every 2 inches you dig down, the radiation level doubles and doubles because it's all still there.
How did you come to connect the Manhattan Project with the whole matter of homeland security in current day America?
Well, the monologues gestate over a number of years, and I'd known for a long time that I wanted to talk about sort of the evolution, sort of the Manhattan Project after the Manhattan Project, like what happened to Los Alamos after the big celebration, the end of World War II. We all sort of took our eye off of that place and became the world's largest weapons laboratory. But I also, I've been very compelled by, as many of us have, the changes in my country over the last 7 or 8 years. And I think that it was realizing that I wanted to talk about the changes after 9/11 in the context of the larger story of American security. That's what really united them.
You said that they gestate over a long period of time. It was just a few months ago, 5 months ago, that you were performing How Theater Failed America. So you were working on this, obviously, while you were still doing that piece, which made a lot of people fans of Mike Daisy.
Or enemies.
Enemies.
Really.
Well, I'm sure you outrage some people, but that's all part of the deal, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
If you're going to take strong positions.
Yeah.
Why is Sam Cohn, one of the scientists who was involved in the Manhattan Project, also a developer of the neutron bomb, was
it? Yes.
Why is he such an important figure for you?
Well, I think he's pivotal because I think one of the problems with talking about the Manhattan Project is the existence of bomb pornography. I think very often when we talk about atomic weapons, the size and scale of them are so shockingly vast that we lose perspective and we fail to talk about them in human ways. So focusing on Sam Cohn, Sam Cohn was at the Manhattan Project, but he was there as a private in the Army. And he worked on the neutron yield team, but as like a low-level researcher with a slide rule just running calculations. And when the geniuses left after after Trinity and after the dropping of the bombs on Japan, it was men like Sam Cohn that actually ran the military-industrial complex. And so his story sort of blossoms from Trinity and onward. And it's kind of important to understand that ordinary people, not super geniuses, you know, make policy decisions and run things.
Does he have any regrets over his role in this?
You know, I think that based on, from reading his book and from I suspect that he regrets not being more effective. He ended up losing his security clearance in some pretty fierce infighting. And I think that I think he regrets that. I think he regrets being perhaps a little naive, because he actually went to other committee members in these very important committees on and talked about the dangers of contracting and outsourcing, and people didn't listen to him.
He was also friends with Herman Kahn, wasn't he?
Yes, they were.
Now, Herman Kahn was a genius, or is a genius, for better or worse.
For better or for worse.
Did you really read his book on on thermonuclear war when you were a kid?
Yes, I did.
That was heavy stuff, wasn't it?
It was. I was a strange little kid. I was a misanthropic child. And I actually read it in my bed under the covers after Lights Out with a flashlight.
Well, what did you think of it? Herman Kahn applied systems theory and game theory to a consideration of the consequences of a thermonuclear war and actually suggested that it wouldn't be the worst thing that ever happened to this country.
It wouldn't be so bad. Yeah, I found it riveting. And I found it deeply compelling because I was you know, like I was saying, I was a very misanthropic child, and like I think part of the purpose of doing the monologue, there's sort of a personal thread that runs through it. It's quieter than some of the personal threads I have in other monologues, but there's a personal thread of what it was like to be a kid without a lot of friends who would read these books, and I really felt I was powerless in my life, and I really enjoyed reading about weaponry like this, and I think that that's something that happens even to adults when they deal with weapons like this in the military.
Well, you say that Sam Cohn was a little in love with the apocalypse. So were you a little in love with the notion of the apocalypse as well?
Oh, yes, very much so. Very much so. I mean, I have no doubt of that. And I think a lot of us are. I think that part of the process of maturing, you know, is starting to recognize that that tendency, that desire for everything to be eradicated and wiped clean, when it asserts itself in human history, it doesn't turn out very well, and it tends to lead to really pretty terrible atrocities.
My guest is Mike Daisy, whose latest performance piece. Are we calling it a performance piece? Are we calling it a one-man play? Are we calling it a monologue?
I usually call them monologues.
His latest monologue is being performed at Joe's Pub at the Public Theater through November 30th, also being filmed now?
Yes, we're making a film.
And after you leave, the musicians come in and do what they usually do at Joe's Pub. You tell the story of having your wallet stolen once when you were visiting Rome. Now, why is that relevant to this story?
Oh, it's very relevant because it's very important when people are talking about security issues. It's very easy for us to not find something on our scale as human beings. And actually, I dissect my own psychology after I've been pickpocketed. And it achieves something that I try to do in the monologues, where it's personal and, you know, it's funny. But it also sort of pokes at reactive security, which is very often on a national level, we react to a security concern. Something happens, it breaches our security. And because security is often transparent, like we don't see it in our day-to-day lives, when it breaks, it often shatters like glass. It's often brittle, and then we freak out.
So one guy tried to smuggle explosives in the sole of his shoe, and now we all take off our shoes when we go to the airport.
Right, despite the fact that the scanners that we put our shoes into cannot actually detect the kind of explosive that was in the shoes that were originally used, nor any sort of theoretical shoe that would have an explosive in it.
Well, you'd think that all you have to do is look at the sole and realize that this one's too thin to have anything
right
in it, and leave it at that. I could just hold my foot up and they could see, you know, that my shoes are not dangerous.
Right, and that would rely on physical inspection. We rely on human intelligence. And the current system is set up in Homeland Security to rely on human intelligence as little as possible. That's why we pay the people so little and we buy such expensive equipment from contractors.
Do you think that we're experiencing a kind of terror fatigue?
Oh, yes. Yes, for a long time now. I think that's very true. And I think what's worse is that the terror fatigue that we're experiencing numbs us to the fact that even before we started to experience the fatigue, the systems we are using are not only invasive and not only are they expensive needlessly, they're not effective. They're not even good security. It's not as though we violated our own rights and then got good security. We still got terrible security.
Now, how much research did you do here? You went to Trinity site. You went to Los Alamos. Did you speak to the Department of Homeland Security?
I didn't speak to the Department of Homeland Security. They're not terribly forthcoming. There isn't really a public face on them to speak to. I did talk to some prominent security experts, including Bruce Schneier and a number of reached out to a number of different independent security experts, and I just read an enormous amount about security and the state of our infrastructure. And when I was in Los Alamos, I met with people who've worked on the weapons programs.
Well, many people have talked about the trade-off between a sense of security and the freedoms that we feel were guaranteed to us as citizens of this country. How do we affect that kind of balance?
Well, I think the first step is to realize that those two things are not in relationship to each other. There's a very common trope in the security industry, the belief that if we have more freedom, therefore we will have less security. If we want to have more security, we'll of course then have to have less freedom. They're not actually connected to one another. They are in relationship. There are things you can do to increase security that do reduce freedom, but it's not a one-to-one correlation. And there's a very common misconception in the security infrastructure now that that's how it actually works.
You're saying that when the military, government, and corporate sectors converge, you don't just see a rise in paranoia, but also a systematic manipulation of human weaknesses to get everyone to conform to a system that ultimately benefits no one.
Yes. Yes, I think that's largely
true. Is that
true?
The message?
That's largely true. I mean, it's a depressing message in some ways, and in many ways, you know, the monologue is terrifying because, you know, even I feel like I've lived with these things a long time. It's kind of terrifying to talk through them each night and to build the chains of logic and lay them out and to leaven them with humor. Dark humor when possible, but still the goal of that humor is to allow us to actually swallow, put our mouths all the way around some pretty terrible things, because you like to believe we all have the best of intentions, but I think we all know how well best intentions work.
You're doing this at Joe's Pub until November 30th, the end of this month. I'm assuming you're going to take this around the country the way you've taken your previous pieces around the country.
Yes, yes.
Do you ever go back to the old ones? Will we ever see How Theater Failed America again?
Yes, the I keep them in rotation. So there are quite a few of them now. So it's hard to keep them all up. But I'll be doing How Theater Failed America in Washington D.C. in January, and we'll be having sessions there, working with the community of D.C. Talking about theater. There's also hope to release How Theater Failed America, the audio and video of it, for free on the web, to just to get the conversation rolling and to get word out there.
If you want more information about tickets and performances, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Find out all about Mike Daisy's latest piece, If You See Something, Say Something. It's at Joe's Pub at the Public Theater through November 30th. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Up next, Pat O'Connor takes your calls on our crazy English language. She'll talk about the oddities of pairs and why we say a pair of scissors or a pair of pants, but not a pair of brassieres. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'll be right back. Stay with us.